There are lions in the neighborhood. My daughter saw one up the street in the playground of the elementary school. The presence of these lions among us leads us to ask, can the wild and the tame just get along?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 666th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there along the shores of Manila Bay who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Carol Stafford. Okay, folks, late one evening some time ago, daughter Kelsey took her dog Artemis for a walk in the large grassy playground of the neighborhood elementary school. A lot of people walk their dogs there after dark, but this time Kelsey was running late and it was dark. After topping a knoll into the grounds, Kelsey noticed that Artemis was shaking uncontrollably and whining as if terrified of something. Looking out into the dark, Kelsey saw the lion. About 15 feet away, she said. Later I asked, how did you know it was a lion and not a big house cat? That was easy, she said. It was much bigger than most big dogs, and it had a huge tail that flicked back and forth. But what really got me were its eyes. The look of those eyes was one of the most frightening things I've ever seen. Kelsey picked up Artemis, who was now barking her head off, and back down the hill, screaming at the top of her voice. The neighbors came running, and the mountain lion slinked off into the night. It's a fact. The lions are moving into our neighborhood, and our neighborhoods are moving into the lions. At one time in our history, this mingling of the wild and the tame would have resulted in the wild being rubbed out. But times have changed, and the tame have come to appreciate having some wild left in the world. And so we have grizzly bears, wolves, and mountain lions hunting along the fringes of civilization. But as the lions move in and the neighbors move out, wild and tame will meet, which leads us to ask, can the wild and the tame just get along? Here to help us hunt for an answer today, we have Chris Wilmers, who's a wildlife biologist, ecologist at the University of California. Chris, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thank you.
Let's see. We still have trouble here, Nikki. Let's see. We'll turn this up here. I can't hear Chris.
Can you hear me now?
Okay. Can you hear? Are you there? I can hear now, Chris.
Okay. I can hear you just fine.
Okay, good. Minor technical difficulty. Chris, welcome to the Food Chain, ecologist and associate professor, University of California, Santa Cruz and Berkeley, is that right?
I'm an assistant professor at University of California, Santa Cruz.
Okay. And I thought I saw something from you from UC Berkeley as well, is that true?
Yeah, that's where I got my PhD.
Okay, good. So mountain lions in the San Francisco Bay areas, wolves in Yellowstone, holy smokes, wild man.
Yeah, I'm generally interested in top predators and how they affect food chains and how they influence the entire ecosystem and, mm-hmm. and what the potential threats are to them and what the threats are of them to us.
Well, one of the things that fascinates me about wildlife, and coming from Montana and the Yellowstone Park area, I've been around enough of it, Why are we city people so fascinated with the wildlife? Why do we want to hold them and bring them back and protect them? And I guess I'll ask you because you're very much there.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's just city people. I think there's people in rural areas and suburban areas and urban areas that on both sides who have a great appreciation and love for wildlife and want to see wildlife in the coexisting with us, and then whether you're from the city or the country, there's also people who are fearful of wildlife and want to tame it, so to speak.
Well, we know there are a lot of people who want to see it back, but why? I mean, what is it about us, the city people, that want to see that wild still there? Have you ever thought about that?
That's a good question. I think not sure I'd agree with you that it's just city people who want wildlife back.
Right.
But, you know, I think there's something about being human that we like natural environments. And as we learn more about natural environments, we find out that they're not so natural anymore when we remove the wildlife from them.
And especially the predators, too.
Yeah, especially the predators, because they often have a outsized role in how that ecosystem works. Some of analogize that a predator is like the keystone in an arch, and if you take that keystone out, the entire arch collapses. And in the same way, if you take the predator out, the ecosystem starts to fall apart.
And I guess we, you know, have seen this around in a number of places, of course Yellowstone Park being one of them. We you know, took wolves out of the environment, and then we brought them back in. And you're looking at the wolves up there. What do you see?
In terms of the effects of wolves on that ecosystem? You know, it's sort of a gradual process, but they seem to be having some pretty major effects. For instance, grizzly bears and coyotes and ravens and eagles that had a pretty hard time up there in the winter and the spring are now doing quite well walking around on the landscape scavenging from wolf kills.
Wow.
We've even started to see in some areas of the western U.S. grizzly bears forgoing hibernation altogether because they feel they can do better by following the wolves around and eating off of their kills. Another thing we're starting to see is the vegetation coming back along the creeks. Where willow and cottonwood have been absent for 75 years since the wolf was extirpated in the late 20s, you have willow and aspen coming back up along the creeks, and that provides shade that lowers the stream temperatures and is good for the native cutthroat trout. We're seeing beavers starting to move back into those systems, songbirds that require those willows to nest in, and so, you know, that the effects of wolves is having quite a ripple. I think it'll be quite a long time, though, before we see the sort of ultimate effects because, you know, these vegetation communities take a long time to recover.
Why mountain lions? What led you to look at mountain lions?
Well, I think it was partially my experience working in Yellowstone that I started to gain a real curiosity about how predators affect ecosystems. And we've started to learn quite a bit about how wolves impact ecosystems, but relatively little is known about the effects of mountain lions. And so when I got my job here with this, you know, local predator in our midst, I thought it would be a great opportunity to ask those questions. And then, of course, here the situation with wildlife is very different in Yellowstone than in Yellowstone. In Yellowstone, we've got this large expanse of public land where wildlife is protected, whereas here in the Santa Cruz Mountains, sort of more similar to the rest of the world where there's increasing human development, and that's fragmenting the habitat. And we need to understand how this kind of development and fragmentation impacts wildlife through influencing their movement patterns and their abilities to survive, so that we can design development so that it doesn't just cut wildlife off, so to speak.
And mountain lions have an incredible range throughout the United States, do they not? I received this email from Orange, Vermont. We see them, our neighbors have seen them. They killed our sheep. They don't exist according to the state, but they're certainly here. So where are they everywhere? Mountain lions?
No, they're in the U.S. They're they go as far east approximately as the Mississippi River. They're moving slowly to the east.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great website called the Eastern Cougar Network, and it has a range map, and then it has documented sightings of cougars throughout the U.S. And people do say they see them in the Northeast, for instance. But the thing about a mountain lion is, even though they're cryptic and they're scarce, and you're unlikely to see them. If there were a mountain lion in an area, somebody would hit it on the road or somebody would take a picture of it.
Which is what's been going on around here. Folks, you're tuned into the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Chris Wilmers, who is a wildlife ecologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We're talking about the mountain lions among us, and they are among us. The question today is, can we just get along with the wild lions of the neighborhood? What do you think? Have any questions today for Chris? Pick up your phone and join us. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-4790. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Chris Wilmers, who is a wildlife ecologist from the University of California, Santa Cruz. We're talking about the lions among us, the lions that are out there in the neighborhood. Chris, I've seen a wild lion, mountain lion, up in the Bull Mountains of Montana, but I've, in spite of stomping all over the countryside of the area, I have not seen any here. So how do you go about studying something you can never see? They're just so shy and so sly, they just don't want to be seen.
Yeah, that's a great question. We got to do that. We've got to take advantage of modern technology, and we've developed a collar that collects GPS locations so we can know where the animal is, and then has a digital three-axis accelerometer and magnetometer in it.
A what? What did you say? What was that?
A magnetometer is a digital compass, and an accelerometer is a little microchip that measures acceleration.
Wow! So like you could tell direction. You could tell direction and airspeed, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And these are things that you see more and more in consumer electronics, like the iPhone and the Nintendo Wii, and we put them on a collar, and that way we can kind of tell where the animal is, and we can tell what they're doing, whether they're running or walking or drinking or eating, and then we can see how that varies depending on where they are and who they are and that sort of thing.
How do you retrieve the information?
Well, we catch the animal and put the collar on, and then the GPS data we can download remotely over radio waves, and the accelerometer data we gotta catch the animal again to retrieve the collar from.
Well, we have Christian on the line, who has probably one of the more interesting questions we'll face today, and perhaps you could help him out. Chris Wilmers, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here, and we're talking the mountain lions among us. Christian, sounds like you've had some mountain lions among your neighborhood, right?
Yeah, I live up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and in the last 2 months, we've had 2 sheep taken by mountain lions, and my neighbors had a couple goats.
Mm-hmm. Was that the goat featured in this morning's newspaper?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's my neighbor. And so over the last 2 months, a mountain lion's taken 4 of our animals.
Sounds like some mountain lions found some easy pickings.
Yeah, that's what we think. He's got a little livestock buffet going on up here.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering if there are any long-term strategies we can employ to try to coexist with these lions, because, this lion's obviously proven to be a threat, but if he moves on or is taken out of the equation, there are going to be other ones to fill its niche. So I was just wondering if there are any strategies we can employ to, keep the mountain lion, you know, at their distance and not, or not attacking the livestock?
Well, there's the question.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, certainly lions have a hard time resisting goats and sheep. And so if you have goats and sheep and they're unprotected, eventually you're going to get a lion in there. You know, I think people have had a lot of success with livestock guard dogs. Guard dogs, yeah.
Like a Great Pyrenees or something, or I don't know what they use.
Yeah, you know, I'm not, I don't know the which breeds they use and which are the best, but I would imagine that you could find out pretty quickly with a Google search. And I think the Department of Fish and Game has some strategies posted on their website about how to protect your livestock. And then I think, I believe the Mountain Lion Foundation also has some information on their website about how to protect livestock. But, you know, the two strategies, a guard dog, and it's got to be a good guard dog, can work quite well. And then I've heard people have success with llamas as well.
The tip I saw listed in the paper today was to keep your animals inside at night.
Yeah, that's always preferred. And you know, also if you have dogs and cats, to bring the dog food inside and bring the animals inside at night. You know, that keeps from attracting animals and obviously keeps your animals safe. Most of our lions are active between dusk and dawn.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, Christian, you have yourself, as you say, a livestock smorgasbord up there. All the neighbors have pets, and all the pets are outside. And
well, yeah, so, you know, my neighbor who just lost the goat, I didn't read, I guess he was written up in the paper, but I didn't read the article, but I know he kept it in a pen. He had a floodlight on. He had music playing, and he went to some extent to keep his animals safe, and this lion seems pretty persistent.
A neighbor said they saw it leaping the fence, and that was the end of the goat.
Yeah, that was the end of the goat. And then you know, I'd heard that there was a case recently where a mountain lion, I mean, you mentioned one of the defense strategies is a llama, but I heard of a llama got taken out on Summit Road by a mountain lion, so.
Huh.
I guess
certainly no strategy is going to be 100% foolproof.
But there's no, like, scent you can set up on your property, or there's no sound wave type of device. I don't know. I'm just grabbing at straws here.
Not that I've heard of. You know, yeah. If the fence had a top on it, that would certainly prevent the mountain lion from coming in. But, you know, if you think about your house cats and how high they can jump, and you just magnify that a bit.
But now, is it normal predatory behavior for them to go after livestock, or is that a sign that they're becoming more socialized and
becoming more familiar with the neighborhood? That's a good question. Their normal food is deer, right?
Yeah, but I think goats and sheep are kind of within that normal range. I mean, a goat is very similar in size to a deer, and pretty much everywhere in the western United States that you have goats, you've got lions feeding on them. And they just sort of can't resist it. They're walking around looking for a deer or a pig or something to eat, and they see this deer-like animal that is fairly helpless, and it's just easy pickings for them.
Well, I just think it's interesting because we've had our livestock for about 7 years, and we never had any. Last summer, I had two pygmy goats that were taken, I assumed as a mountain lion. And then this year, we've had the two, and then my neighbor had another two. But before that, there wasn't any trouble, and he's had livestock for a long time, so I don't know, it just seems like the activity has intensified as of late, and I don't know if
that's a good question.
That portends a trend to come or not.
What do you think, Chris? Are we having more mountain lions in the neighborhood?
You know, I couldn't say for sure because nobody's, looked at that question in the Santa Cruz Mountains. My My guess would be that the populations haven't changed much recently. I think, you know, certainly in the early 70s, there were next to no mountain lions in the entire state, and that's when Ronald Reagan passed a moratorium on mountain lion hunting. And since then, the populations have grown, but my guess is that by the 90s, they were already kind of, you know, at saturation levels. And that, you know, when you do start to get a problem with a mountain lion in your neighborhood, it's either because you just sort of got found by a particular mountain lion.
That's the way I sensed it.
That's probably the main thing. And then, you know, with mountain lion sightings and stuff like that, sometimes the more people become aware of mountain lions, the more likely they are to report having seen one. And then, you know, even if the numbers aren't changing, it can lead to a perception that they are.
Christian, thank you for the call, folks.
You're
welcome. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Chris Wilmer, and we are talking The Lions Among Us with you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, the lions, they are among us. It's easy to see by a quick scan of the newspaper, but they seem to be just about everywhere that people are, and it's probably because people are growing into their territory, too. So that is the issue, isn't it, Chris? We seem to be growing out at a rapid pace and taking over a lot of that habitat, and what's left are kind of becoming like islands in the stream, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
So how do the lions move about? You've got this wonderful tracking technology. You can track their acceleration, their direction. You can tell when they're sitting still. You can tell just about everything. So how do they move about without bumping into us so frequently?
Well, they're as you can tell, they're pretty good at it. I mean, the people who do see mountain lions are pretty few of us, and you know, for one, they're mostly just active at night,
mm-hmm.
and so they sort of do it in the dark. And then the other is that, you know, for the most part, they're where we see mountain lions are where there's still, you know, relatively large, undeveloped tracts of land. And you know, so you think about the Santa Cruz Mountains; those are areas like, you know, north of Santa Cruz, in the big state parks like Big Basin or Nicene Marks or some of the county parks and open space districts, and some of the sort of larger tracts of private land. And then to the extent that...
You're working also on the Diablo Range outside of...
No, we're not.
You're not?
No.
Oh, okay. So you just focused on the Santa Cruz Mountains area then?
Yeah, that's right.
Have you ever seen a mountain lion yourself? I mean, without trying to track one down and put a collar on it. Have you ever seen one just out strolling about in the wilderness?
I've never seen one fair and square.
How do you catch them to put a collar on them?
Well, we've got a few different techniques. We use hound dogs. We also use cages and leg hold snares. Mm-hmm. All are sort of quite effective and safe for the animals.
So with the dogs, you tree them?
Yeah, the dogs, we kind of drive slowly along these dirt roads with our heads out the window looking for tracks. And then once we find a fresh track, we'll let the dogs out, and the dogs will kind of sniff around, and they'll keep sniffing until they, you know, see the lion, and then they'll start barking like hell and chase it up a tree, and then we'll come along and anesthetize it with a tranquilizer dart. Mm-hmm.
And then you have the information. That must be an incredible thing to look at and to interpret. From that information, what do you see? What kind of lifestyle do the mountain lions lead?
Well, it depends on if you're a male or if you're a female. The males and the females have very different lifestyles. The females have sort of relatively small home ranges of about 25 to 40 square miles, and they're just sort of focused on killing prey. So they have these sort of smaller daily movements, and they're sort of on the little game, the D trails, trying to hunt deer, and basically get as much food as possible to raise their pup, their cubs. If you're a male mountain lion, you've got this huge home range. Our male mountain lions have home ranges of over 100 square miles. And they're basically cruising around trying to find as many females to breed with as possible and keep other males out of their territory. And so with any given male, there might be, you know, 3 to 5 females in his territory. And he's really defending the females from other males rather than he is defending his sort of food resource.
Does he feed himself? Okay,
yeah.
So it's not like a pride of lions where the females feed the males.
No, males are mountain lions are a solitary animal. So, the males and females are by themselves unless, except for the 5 days out of the year when they're breeding.
Mm-hmm.
And then the females are either by themselves or with their cubs.
Okay, good. Let's go to Richard. Richard, welcome to the Food Chain. Pleased to have you aboard. We're talking with Chris Wilmers, University of California, Santa Cruz. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I wanted to ask Chris, how many lions has he tagged to date? You don't put a collar on them.
Yeah, we've tagged 13 lions. 10 of those are adults, and 3 of them are kittens.
In the Santa Cruz Mountains?
That's right.
And that's it?
We started. We only started a little bit over a year ago. So, first year was our pilot study, and then we're sort of getting up and running into a sort of full-fledged study. And that's not the whole population. That's just sort of the animals we've caught up with so far.
What do you estimate the whole population at?
We haven't done a sort of scientific estimate. If I had to guess, I'd guess that there's between, 30 and 70 lions in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
I think you're off by maybe 40 or 50. I bet there's at least 100 in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Could be.
And I think if you go farther north into the Redwood Curtain there, you're going to find even more. What I don't understand is what are all these people doing with sheep, goats, and farm animals in the redwoods?
Feeding lions.
I know they're feeding the lions, but I mean they're complaining about the lions. And I don't know, growing up here, being born here, I was told that the lions were down on the beach before men and women came here. Now, maybe the lions and the goats and the sheep and all that should be down on the beach. I don't...
Why would they be on the beach?
I mean, if there was nobody, the reason why they're up in the mountains is because they can't go to the beach,
mm-hmm.
Right?
It's kind of like grizzly bears. Used to be...
Exactly. I mean, imagine a time when there was no humans here and the animals run the place. I mean, I remember walking right-of-ways, old train track paths in Ziani and up on Summit Road. And just be walking along during the daytime, a mountain lion pretty much wasn't going to bother you. They were just crossing the road.
Yeah, have you seen mountain lions?
I've seen tons of them.
You have.
And what used to get me was when they would run over them, and it was a big deal. If it was a big cat, it actually got his picture in the paper.
Well, that just happened here.
It was a regular thing back in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nowadays, you got all these houses up here in these mountains. And they want these animals out. I guess just like they did when they wanted them off the beach.
So, Chris, how do the lions negotiate all of these neighborhoods and get from one place to the other? I mean, if you're a male mountain lion, you're covering a lot of turf. So,
that's right. So that's something we're looking into, and we're just sort of at the beginning stages of our study. So, the short answer is I don't really have the answer yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're trying to find out. But, if I were to hypothesize a little bit, based on what I've seen, the lions tend to seek out these sort of large areas of open land, and that's sort of what their core home ranges are. And then, if there's houses that are scattered, hundreds of yards apart from each other, they'll sort of they'll kind of move through those areas to get from one large habitat patch to another.
Unless they happen to have some nice, fat, juicy goats.
And these hills really come alive at night, right?
The lions are active mostly at night, that's right. But
quick break.
There's certain areas that they can't negotiate very well. So, for instance, you know, these highly developed areas and roads like Highway 17 are a real obstacle for lions.
Okay, we have to take a quick break back. Please do stay tuned, everybody. 831-479-1080. Well, they're here. They're there. They're just about everywhere where there's an environment for them, where there's food. We're talking lions, mountain lions in particular. And we're talking about the mountain lions of the San Francisco Bay region and the Monterey Bay area here. And we're talking with Chris Willmer, who is the wildlife ecologist for University of California, Santa Cruz. Chris, you've got these wonderful devices that track direction, speed, not only speed, but accelerating speed. Which would indicate what? When you see an acceleration, what would that mean?
Well, the way I think of it is, it's not telling us the speed from the accelerations itself. What it's doing is it's sort of giving us an EKG pattern, so to speak, of how the neck is moving. And so if you imagine every time the animal's foot hits the ground, say if it's walking or running, it's going to give us a sort of wiggle in the accelerometer data, because that shock wave goes up through the leg and into the neck and registers in the accelerometer signature. And so then we can look at, you know, how far the distance is between shock waves, and we can say, okay, well, this animal's hitting the ground with its front foot every, you know, fraction of a second, and then from that we can calculate how fast he's moving.
But what would that indicate when you see a sprint? A mountain lion sprinting, that would indicate that it's probably attacking something?
Yeah, probably. You know, these cats, they don't really run unless they've got a good reason to.
Mm-hmm.
So it would either mean it's sort of maybe sprinting off the road because a car is coming, or that it's going after a prey. And then if it's going after a prey, then we'll see some kind of struggle in the accelerometer signature. You know, we'll see this sort of crazy pattern that would indicate that maybe they're attacking prey, and then that'll be followed shortly thereafter, hopefully, by, you know, the animal feeding, and then that would be a different pattern as well.
Wow. So have you ever used this information to track down a kill?
Not yet. This is still early days with the accelerometer. What we have used to track down kills are the GPS data. Now, the GPS, you can also tell the animal's made a kill because they'll typically stay in the same area and feed for hours or days at a time, and then that is represented by a cluster in the GPS data. And so we look at those clusters, and then we go and visit those spots to see what they're feeding on.
Mm-hmm. Have you actually seen a kill that in that way?
Oh, yeah, we've seen dozens of them.
Uh-huh.
They're primarily eating the black-tailed deer, and we've seen a few pigs and an occasional raccoon or coyote.
Yeah, probably little pigs, right?
Little pigs, mostly, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. And do you have any idea of how they go about making their kill, their attack? Have you ever seen any data or anything on that?
Say that again?
How they go about making a kill?
Well, they're an ambush predator, and, you know, we've got indirect evidence from other studies that they often will make the kill when the animal's in its sleeping bed. That's what we've seen in Yellowstone a lot when lions kill elk, is that they do it right when the animal is sleeping. And then the other way is, you know, they'll see a deer or something, and they'll stalk up on it. Try to get as close as they can, and then surprise it and attack it from behind. I think usually, although this isn't really known for sure, but my guess is that if the animal sees the lion and runs, that the lion's probably not going to pursue it.
If an animal sees a lion and runs,
yeah,
then the lion will not chase it.
Right. The lion's chief advantage is in surprise. So they're trying to, you know, surprise the animal and subdue it before it even has a chance to run away. If it has a chance to run, then, you know, the lion is good for a short burst, but they can't sustain a long chase like a wolf or a coyote might be able to do.
Right. So it's an ambush predator then. It sneaks up and gets you when you're sleeping or not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a quick question from the facts here. Is it true that if you call about a cougar in a schoolyard, the animal control will not relocate the cat, rather they'll just kill it? How do we manage sightings? You know, to, like, you know, there's a lion in the schoolyard. What do we do?
You know, I think I'm certainly not the authority on this. You know, this is where someone from Fish and Game would be able to give
right.
you a better answer. But, you know, my understanding is you just scare it away or call the Fish and Game warden and ask them what to do. You know, usually this is on a case-by-case basis. If there's a reason to think that the animal is a substantial threat, then they might do something about it. Otherwise, you know, a lion just casually walking past the schoolyard once might not be a threat. If it were to lurk there, and you might get worried about it.
Okay, well, we have a few minutes left, and when we come back, I'd like to ask Chris Wilmers, you know, what we should do to make it easier for our friends, the wild animals, to survive out there. And we can probably do that by not getting them into trouble and by keeping ourselves out of trouble. So we'll ask Chris, you know, given all that he knows, what can we do if we happen to run across a mountain lion out there in the wilderness, which might be the neighborhood, who knows. Given what's been going on in the neighborhoods around here, it could very well be. If you have a quick question you'd like to ask Chris, pick up your phone and join us. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. I am Michael Olson. This is The Food Chain. We're talking with Chris Wilmers, University of California. Do stay tuned. Well, they're out there, folks, out there on the fringes of our neighborhoods. So how do we get along with them? Chris Wilmer might know. He's the research ecologist, a associate professor at University of California, Santa Cruz, and he's looking into mountain lions among us. Chris, what would you do if you happen to walk into and meet a mountain lion out there in the sticks in the neighborhood someplace?
Well, I'd take a good look because I'd be curious as heck. But
right.
I was worried, I would probably stand tall and make a lot of noise and try to scare it off. And if he came closer and looked like he was going to attack, then I'd run like heck.
Okay. And, I heard you're not supposed to run. So you
wouldn't... Well, that's what they used to say. There's a new report that's just come out in the last year that sort of...
goes against that.
It's looked at encounters with mountain lions across the West and sort of looked at what people did and what they didn't do and sort of tried to evaluate what the best strategy was.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed to imply that you actually should run.
Yes, sir.
You know, these are...
these are all speculation, right?
Yeah, they're all speculative.
Well, Chris, you look at wolves in Yellowstone, you're looking at the mountain lions in the West, in the metropolitan areas of the West. And, you know, it's obvious that as we grow and as our communities grow and expand out into the countryside, we're just going to keep running up against the wildlife that lives there. Is there a way that you see that we can get along with these critters?
Yeah, we need to be thinking more carefully about where we develop and where we don't develop. And we need to be thinking more and more about connectivity of the landscape. So we've done a great job, you know, particularly in the Santa Cruz Mountains, for instance, of setting aside open space, whether it's county parks or state parks or open space districts. There's a lot of big open land. But what we haven't thought so well about is how those landscapes are connected and whether there's the ability for wildlife like mountain lions and deer and coyotes and all kinds of animals to move from one of these protected areas to the other. So we need to be thinking more about, you know, these smaller protecting smaller parcels that might connect these big protected areas. And we need to be thinking about how we design roads so that, you know, they might have underpasses or overpasses for wildlife to get across them. And that's sort of the big challenge for, I think, wildlife conservation and the 21st century is thinking about how to keep the landscape connected so that these animals can move around.
Okay, really quickly, Juanita, go ahead.
Yeah, I read about a device that there's this emits a high frequency where it would ward off an attacking dog. Is there such a device that would emit a high frequency for cats?
Thank you, Chris.
I'm not aware of one. That doesn't mean one doesn't exist.
All right, there you go. Chris Wilmer, thank you so much for joining us today on The Food Chain. Been fascinating talking about mountain lions among us, and they're out there. And really enjoyed the conversation and look forward to more down the line. Appreciate it a whole bunch. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Well, remember, join us next week for more What's Eating What Radio, and above all, remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.